Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. Today's show ventures between the realms of TV, music and literature. And to help me stay on track, I've enlisted the help of a couple of experts on those matters. Joining me in the studio are the broadcaster and DJ Georgie Rogers and arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, Alice Vincent. Elsewhere on the show, we'll head to Milan to find out the top dogs of the independent Italian publishing scene. We'll discuss what the new global novel is with poet and critic Adam Kirsch. And we'll speak to composer Sven Helbig about what classical music means in 2017. Plenty to come, so hold on tight as we delve headfirst into the Monocle Arts Review right here on Monocle 24. Alice and Georgie, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I don't need to introduce you to yourselves because you've just done that and realised that you're old friends and that everything's fine and it was this night and it was that and it was amazing. So it's great. I'm glad we've kind of found a kind of very nice collegiate environment with which to kind of discuss our cultural topics today.
Yeah, we're all mates here.
We're all friends here, right? Yes, good stuff. Alice, we're going to kick off with you. We're going to talk TV. We're going to hear a clip from The Handmaid's Tale to get our listeners into the strange vibe of the Margaret Atwood novel adaptation. And we'll hear from you off the back of it. How are we feeling in terms of the spookiness of The
Already
Handmaid's
quite
Tale?
Tense.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Generally tense, to be honest.
Generally tense with the whole thing or just with The Handmaid's
just
Tale?
Just with life. No. Handmaid's Tale. Tense.
Okay. Without further ado then, let's chill ourselves to our bones.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen. When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake. My name is Offred. I had another name.
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
The spooky sounds of The Handmaid's Tale, Alice Vincent, yes.
It's all a little too close to home sometimes, isn't it?
Isn't it a little bit? So talk us through this one. This is from Hulu.
It is from Hulu.
A production thereof.
Yes. And for the uninitiated, Hulu is kind of the sort of sometimes floundering little sister to streaming giants Netflix and Amazon Prime. And this is their first major sit-up-and-listen TV offering. It's an adaptation, as you say, of Margaret Atwood's 1985 dystopian novel in which the world is struck by infertility and plague and a kind of Christian political force has taken over. And as a result, only a few women are fertile and they are farmed out to very rich and powerful men to give them children.
I mean, it's an absolutely amazing novel, isn't
it?
It's something that a man could not have written.
Right.
Which is a strange thing, because it seems sort of... I remember reading the back of this book and thinking what a Ballardian conceit it was, and then how much sort of more clever and lush and exciting it turned out to be. How does it turn out on screen?
Beautifully. Really beautifully.
Yeah.
So there's so much attention to detail in it. You know, when they were making it, they painted some walls like four different times to get the colours just right. And the cinematographer is Reed Morano, who was behind Beyoncé's Lemonade and also Vinyl, which was the HBO show last year. Yeah. So, you know, we've got, you know, so much effort on making it look beautiful. It is also, as you say, chilling to the bone. It makes things all a little too real. Some of the flashbacks are very much set in contemporary times. They've got smartphones, they're listening to Subtract, like that summer of 2011. The timing is so eerily spot on. And obviously with all the kind of events going on in America's political turmoil at the moment, there are a lot of people being like, is this the worst PR campaign for the best thing ever going to, you know? It's all very close to home.
And talk us through the dramatis personae and who are the runners and riders in this?
So Elizabeth Moss plays a woman who in this new world, her name is Offred, as in of Fred. She belongs to a man named Fred. And she is our guide through this world. We hear her internal monologue in the same way that Margaret Atwood writes it. And she was also a producer on the show. So Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men fame is very well connected to it. Other than that, we've got Samira Wiley, who some will recognise from Orange is the New Black. She played Puse. She's her gay best friend, who is also a handmaid. And, you know, the rest of the show, we've got basically her keepers and a woman who we just know as the aunt, who kind of indoctrinates them all into this horrible world.
And how important is this for Hulu's brand? You sort of preface it by saying they kind of haven't quite got there, you know, and all the rest of it.
It's
compared to obviously
important.
Netflix and even Amazon. Is this really a marker in the sand for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the equivalent of when Netflix went from just pumping out movies to creating House of Cards and then it won a load of Emmys. or when Amazon Prime brought out Transparent and it was like, look what we can do. I think that's what Handmaid's Tale could be for Hulu.
So head to Hulu for The Handmaid's Tale. It sounds good. I kind of want to listen to the the trailer again.
I know.
Maybe feel really chilly.
I'm sold.
Yeah?
I haven't actually read the book. Is this one where you should read the book before?
Well, I'd be interested to see what your experience is of not reading the book, because the book leads you in the same way the show does, in that it reveals more horrors as the thing goes on. And so if you don't spoil yourself with the book, you might enjoy it more. And then you have the pleasure of Margaret Atwood to read afterwards.
Okay.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? That's the way to do it. Yeah, exactly.
Because then you won't be disappointed as well if it is. You
know, quite.
Not this is good. Same. For actual consumer advice from Alice Vincent to Georgie Rogers. See, I told you they were getting on famously. The Handmaid's Tale was released on Hulu this week. Now let's switch windows to talk to Netflix. Talk to Netflix? Where are we going to talk?
Hi, Netflix.
Maybe. Hi, Netflix.
Hi.
Hi. Their latest hopeful for a hit is Girl Boss. It's based on the real-life story of the entrepreneur Sophie Amoroso, and this tells the story of how she turned selling clothes on eBay into a multi-million dollar fashion label called Nasty Girl. Let's hear a clip.
I want this. I'll give you $8 for it.
No way. The tag says 12.
$9, and I'll give you some free business advice.
Deal. So, what's the advice?
This is an original 1970s East-West calfskin motorcycle jacket in perfect condition. Know what your shit's worth, because you just got played. You know how people flip houses? Well, I flip clothes. Boom! Dollar bills, y'all!
That's what to make of that. It sounds like eBay with a real, really, really muscular soundtrack. But it's not. Tell us why we love Girl Boss. Do we love Girl Boss?
Oh, you know, I really wanted to love Girl Boss.
Okay.
I really did, because in 2006, I was obsessed not with selling things on eBay and buying them. And, you know, I was really looking forward to watching a show that for the first time were kind of a bit like Girls, but even more so put my adolescence and my young adulthood on TV, and I was really excited about that. And the central character, who is based on the real life founder of Nasty Girl, the fashion brand, and wrote the autobiography Girl Boss, and her name is Sophia Amoroso, her TV version is just the most irritating thing in the world.
High praise indeed.
Yeah. But the show is well constructed, it's pacey, it is a kind of pay into the mid-noughties kind of early internet culture, which is a joy to watch. And I think it's just, that's what a lot of discussion online about this show at the moment is raging. It's like, can you get through the first episode? Because I think it gets a lot
too much cringe, is it?
Yeah, I mean, she just says things like that in the trailer.
Yeah, you just got played.
Ka-ching!
All right. Oh, you know, yeah. I bought a pendant for 29p more than someone else was prepared to pay for it. I wish I was dead.
It's almost like you've watched it, Rob.
It's a strange thing, though, because it's such a specific kind of line of inquiry. Do you know what I mean? I mean, think there are political shows. There are programmes about the dystopian future, like Handmaid's Tale. Then there is this. Is this not worthy of an adaptation, do you think, or is it just the way that the adaptation's been played?
I think, you know what, in its defence, it's got a really impressive team behind it. So it's got Kay Cannon from Pitch Perfect creating it. It's got Charlize Theron as an executive producer. Sophia Amoroso is also executive producing. You know, it's really rare to get a TV show with this much heft and promotion from Netflix, which has such a good backing from women. And I think it was going to be put on as kind of, oh, we want to show 19-year-old women in a positive entrepreneurial light at a time when millennials maybe aren't getting the easiest cracks into industry. The unfortunate thing is that Sophia is not somebody that you necessarily want to be, and also in real life has been kind of found guilty of creating horrible toxic atmospheres to work in and firing women who got pregnant. So it's slightly awkward. But the show, I think, is still worth watching. A lot of people are finding it fun, which it is. And I think actually once the show gets past those early episodes of being like, oh, she's such a comedically awful person, it's actually really quite pacey and fun and like, oh, look, she is winning at this eBay game. And it's all that early doors of the internet stuff, which is quite
addictive. So there's a lot of there's a lot of joy in kind of watching it for the production design and the kind of mobile phones they have and the kind of, do you know what I mean? And the
AOL
kind of
Messenger.
Laptops they're doing it. All that kind of stuff, right? Yeah.
There's huge like Apple MacBooks and the clothes. I mean, the conversations I've had about the clothes are like, she would never have worn Levi's 501 then. They were deeply uncool, you know? I mean, Georgie, you were a cool, fashionable kid around the same kind of time. I feel like you would also sit there critically being like, no, but she would not have worn that T-shirt. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know if like triple Adidas leggings, jacket, T-shirt, slouch socks and high tops were, well, I suppose, maybe.
I mean, New Rave maybe hadn't hit San Francisco, but we can but hope.
Yeah.
And what about the language in it? Because from the trailer, it seemed like, or the script, it seemed derivative, kind of Californian, bitch slappy kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it's set in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert on that particular dialect, so I'm maybe not the best person to ask.
Alice Vincent flipping through the dictionary.
Wait, I'll just get my Valley Girl book out.
Urban Dictionary, she watches...
That takes me back.
She watches Girl Boss. Do you think it falls down? Maybe. Do you think it falls down because it's maybe trying a bit too hard to be relevant to... It's been a little bit... I know Netflix don't focus group any of their shows, but it feels like it's trying to be an empowering female story when no such thing is necessarily needed, or it is patronising if they do it that way.
I think you're exactly right. And I think I didn't curate it like this, but to put two shows that have women behind them that deal with female narratives next to each other on this particular show today.
You say you didn't do it. You say you didn't, but George and I are kind of, we are stroking our chins in sort of awe and admiration and wonder.
Oh, look what she's done there. So Handmaid's Tale is far more thought-provoking on women's place in society than Girl Boss's.
Okay, good. So we have a thumbs up for Handmaid's Tale. Not so much for Girl Boss. Maybe you can make it through the first episode. You'll find joy in the bulkiness of the MacBook.
Exactly. There you go. Perfect solution.
And that is out now on Netflix. Before we get to Georgie's music review, we're going to nip over to Milan to talk publishing. Last week, producer Holly was in the city, mostly for broadcasting purposes, but she managed to free up a bit of time to head to an interesting bookshop called Libreria Verso. Spread over two floors, the shop displays some of the best independent Italian publishers, and Holly spoke to the shop's co-founder, Pietro Biancardi, about the ones we should be keeping an eye on at the moment.
There are dozens of very interesting Italian publishers. I will name the one that inspired me and still I admire the most for different reasons. I try to steal the things I like for my publishing house, of course, one of the models in Italy for quality publications and research and trying to take books that are not immediate and they do it since a very long time, it's Adelphi. Adelphi is one of probably the best publishing houses in the world. It's really admired all over the world. They do really beautiful books, both in a graphic way, but also in the content, of course. And then one I have to say is EO. EO, they are friends, they are a couple. They founded the publishing house more than 40 years ago. No, 40 years ago, I think. And they are very brave. They were like, they followed their road all the time. So through successes and miseries, and in the last years it was them who published Elena Ferrante, and it became a world incredible success. They also opened an independent publishing house in the United States, then in the UK. It's called Europe Editions. They are very nice people and they really deserve the success they got. And then, like other very beautiful publishing houses are, for example, Sellerio. It's another publishing house that exists since 40 years, based in Palermo, which is quite unusual because usually in Italy the publishing houses are based either in Milan or in Rome. So in Palermo it's more difficult, but they do these beautiful, beautiful blue books. They're all blue. They have of Italian authors' most interesting list. And then why not to say that, like, Minimum Fax, it's another publishing house that I really love. They were born in 94 from two very young, they were like 20 or something, the founders. They're also a good friend of mine. And they really changed the publishing world in Italy because before them, the publishing was a bit dull, you know? It was very, very serious, very... Everything was a bit stuck. And they published beautiful books. They brought in Italy some... they were specialized both in Italian authors, then on also cinema books. And then they brought lots of underground American writers at the time, underground, that then they became very, very famous. But it was them who brought them in Italy. They rediscovered some classics from the United States. They were completely forgotten, like Raymond Carver, or they discovered David Foster Wallace. And they combined this very beautiful list with parties, fun. All what they touched was fun. And they did this very innovative marketing that then was copied all over the world, this new way of doing publishing, that publishing is a fun thing. So I think they kind of invented this new attitude.
That was Pietro Biancardi at Libreria Verso in Milan, and you're listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bounds. I'm currently joined in the studio by Alice Vincent, who you just heard talking TV, and Georgie Rogers, the latter of whom we turn to now for Music Times. Georgie, you're going to talk about Feist first.
Yes.
I've missed Feist. You've missed Feist. All missed Feist.
Yeah. This is her first album in 6 years.
Yeah.
Follows Metals, which came out back in 2011, and it's called Pleasure. And it's a pleasure. I'm going to be wholly positive.
I love
about
Georgie
this.
Rogers. That's the one word review. I'm glad you get paid by the word because that's a waste.
I often come in here and I try to sort of put my critical head on. I love this. I love this. I almost love this more than anything she's ever done. She's made this album, An Intimate Affair, with her closest friends, Mocky and Renaud Letang. And she said that she was raw and so...
Letang to his close friends.
She said that she was raw and so were the takes. And that's definitely true is what I've heard of the album. It's quite lo-fi, but that's all part of the charm. It does feel very intimate. It feels very raw. In Pleasure, the title track, she really echoes PJ Harvey when she's at her rawest on albums like Rid of Me. And then also a bit of Patti Smith in there. It's kind of angry, but then she's always been one for a melody when you think back to her early stuff like 1, 2, 3, 4 and My Moon, My Man, those kinds of tracks that sort of, even if you haven't listened to Feist for ages, which was kind of the case with me, she suddenly dropped this track and I was like, oh yeah, Feist, I need to
me too, I really enjoyed this record and it made me listen to everything else again.
Exactly, because those tracks, but even if you just think of them, they come to mind with not too much thought, just because of the melodies and the hooks. And so on this, there's just swoonful melodies. There's a couple of tracks, Pleasure, which is the title track, and Century, really, really gorgeous, but then also with a bit of an element of foreboding in them and kind of a darkness. Century features Jarvis Cocker, and it's just this inspired sort of spoken word bit at the end of the track where he's talking about big numbers and hours and seconds, and in his very kind of typical Jarvis lovely way that he does on the radio as well. That just, his voice is sort of like quite, it's like a big hug.
One of the voices you want to get closer to the radio when you hear it.
Yeah, exactly,
it's an attractive quality.
I mean, he could say anything, he could read the alphabet and you know it would be scintillating. So that's just really nice, and there's organs on there, and it's just all, it feels very raw, but it just feels very beautiful. And I've been obsessed with both of these tracks, so I can't wait to hear the full record when it comes out.
I love it when people come on and they love stuff on here, right? I mean, you can hear it. You can hear it come out of Georgie's every fibre of her being. We're going to have a little taster of the title track. This is Pleasure.
Oh, an echo calls out the line. Indication I'm tired. Our togetherness, that is how we to my bed, dreaming.
It's brand new from Feist. It's called Pleasure, from an album of the same name, as recommended by Georgie Rogers. Let's move on to your second pick, Little Cub.
Yes.
Who have pinged into my inbox, but I know very little about. Talk us through these guys.
Yeah, they are pretty new. They've not been together that long, and they've only just been putting singles out for, oh, I want to say, 8 to 10 months. They'd gone away, formed this band, made an album, essentially, and signed by Domino Records. Great record
good pedigree,
company.
Yeah.
Yeah, good pedigree. And then just started trickling out these tracks. They're a London trio, and this is their debut album proper. Duncan, who is in the band, he has worked very closely with George Fitzgerald as a producer. And so he brings this really lush electronic element to this band. And then you've got Dom, who's the singer, who sort of brings this sort of romantic style of singing. And his lyrics are sort of,
They're a pleasure.
He's kind of got this romantic vibe about him. He wears a velvet jacket, a velvet blazer.
He's got a bit of the baritone crew. I tell you what,
should we hear it first? Yeah, and then I'll be able to talk.
Of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have them.
Won't you slow down with me? I'll be
That was Cuts of Television from the LP Still Life. That is out today from Little Cub, the new Little Cub, the trio from London.
Yeah. And as
you're slightly swooning there over the Dom's vocals.
Oh, no, I just, okay. I think they're really great. They've played my I Do A Night, they've played that. They're great live. This album is really, really great. As a debut album, I just feel like it's very cohesive and there's a lot to listen to and lots of, for something that could be boxed in a thing of, oh, it all sounds the same. There's actually quite a lot of variation in the record.
There's a lot of, that's a kind of, a lot, I like the synths there. I like that kind of controlled something of the Blue Nile, something of Ryan there, that kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that sort of deep, progressive electronic sound. But then there's sort of the more indie moments, and then there's also sort of elements of Talking Heads in there. It's lyrically quite intelligent. Like, it feels a bit like a diary. He's very reflective and observant and personal, and it's quite direct. And this kind of groove-based music is... The scene is quite thriving at the moment. You know, you've got LCD Sound System, who are back after a break. Bands like Formation, Boxed In. Ollie Basin of Boxed In mixed this record, and Little Cub have supported him quite a lot on tour.
What happens when a band like this, they release an album at the end of April, and then you've got the summer ahead of you? Is this kind of, is this what they're primed for, kind of festival stuff?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's that melancholy dance music thing. It's quite uplifting, but there was also quite a lot of darkness in it and in the lyrics and everything. But this isn't for maybe when the party's in full swing, but for the end of the night.
But 4 a.m.
Yeah,
4 a.m. stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's to be listened to on a decent sound system or in your headphones. It's really lush. Like, the whole sound of the album just sort of envelops you. And it, I think, for people that love the album as an album, there are still people that don't just listen to two tracks off an album. It does take you on that journey. There is that feel.
People are making shorter LPs. They're making records that are 10 tracks and 38 minutes long or 42 minutes long or something. Far more pleasurable experience than the 16-track behemoths of the CD era, right? I mean, we're kind of back to actually LP length things. It's a good thing, I think.
Although there's a lot of pop records that are putting out deluxe versions. It's very tedious.
They've got previously not good enough to be released material.
The reason why that was left on the cutting floor.
Yeah.
Or worse, sometimes you get the deluxe one. It's just like the artist being like, I wrote this song in my bedroom. And it's like, I didn't ask for this. What is this?
Get out of my bedroom.
No way.
Get me out of your bedroom.
It feels like there's not much dead meat on this album. In fact, probably none. Again, I'm very positive about this.
Good stuff.
And I like them. It's good to see a new British band. Hopefully they'll cut through. They are doing quite a few festivals this summer, and they are great live. But it's just that dance music sound, I'm always a sucker for it, so.
I didn't think you heard what Alice said.
I didn't hear it.
I made a really bad joke.
Did you say
maybe they can become big cubs.
Oh!
Full lionesses.
roaring.
there'll just be a kind of
a windy
kind of shooting star
kind of
sound effects that will go with that. That'll be fine.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah. also, I should mention that Dom's dad is the singer. His dad is a complete super fan. And so they were saying at some point it would be quite fun to make a documentary of the early years of Little Cub, because their Dom's dad, the singer's dad, comes down to pretty much all the shows and films things. But there's usually very little footage of the band playing. It's more him like interviewing people about the band.
Really?
He kind of goes a bit extracurricular and just kind of goes off on tangents. And,
amazing.
Apparently there's hours and hours of footage.
That could go on the deluxe CD,
yeah.
Couldn't
yeah.
it?
For the deluxe.
I think there's a documentary to be made in like super fan dads.
Yeah.
Like yes. With the Mystery Jets, they took that one further and just had their dad in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. So it's something to think about. Right?
Yeah.
Sorry, Dom can't make it tonight, but as his dad's poisoned him. But his dad seems to be fully available to play. Maybe that's the secret thing, is that he wants to be the singer.
Maybe.
We should contact Will at Domino Records and try and find out. Okay. From these little cubs, mighty lions may roar, says Alice. Still Life by Little Cub is out today on Domino Records. Georgie Rogers, thank you very much for your music reviews today. Georgie and Alice are going to stick around for the end of the show. But first, we're going to talk books. Even with the rise of anti-globalisation movements around the world, award-winning poet and critic Adam Kirsch believes in the concept of the global novel, in which a novel resonates in different countries across the globe. In his new book, The Global Novel, Writing the World in the 21st Century, he analyses 8 21st century novelists, ranging from Elena Ferrante to Haruki Murakami. He argues that those authors speak to a global audience different from writers from previous centuries. He spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about his findings.
Well, it's a good question. Is the global novel, which is the thing that I'm trying to define, is it one kind of book, or could it be a variety of approaches? And I think that the 8 writers that I include all take a different approach to what it means to write a global novel. What they have in common is that they've reached a global audience. They've been translated into many languages and read all around the world. And so they're obviously writing things that speak to people all around the world.
And, for example, how would you differentiate those 8 authors from perhaps the most famous authors from the previous century? Do you think perhaps, you know, the stories they tell, it's someone that can read the book in Brazil or in South Africa and they can have the same resonance in those countries?
I think that literature has always been something that crosses borders. It's always been something that can be understood by people far away from the situation, the circumstances in which it was written. What's different about contemporary global fiction, I think, in the 21st century is that the idea of living globally, of participating in a civilization that crosses national borders, has become such an important part of the way we live and the way we think about ourselves. And when that element of our experience becomes central to the novel, you get a new kind of novel. You get a novel that's global in its concerns, even if it might take place only in a small town in Turkey, for example, like Orhan Pamuk's Snow. It's really being written with the entire globe in mind as an audience and as a context.
And many of those books, they talk about, you know, an immigration story, the story of an immigrant. I wonder if you could give me a few examples. And also you differentiate, because in the past also you mentioned, you know, there were books of the immigrant going to America, you know, and discovering a new country and becoming American in a way. But the approach is a bit different, right, these days?
It is. The immigrant story has always been an important part of American literature, the story of people coming to America from different parts of the world and discovering what it means to become an American, what you gain and what you lose in that process. I think what's different now is that thanks to technology and to cheap travel, it's possible to maintain an existence in America, but not of America. And I talk in the book about how immigrant literature is now being supplemented by something I call migrant literature, that is, stories about people who come to America but aren't coming to become Americans, and often they end up leaving. And two of the examples that I talk about are Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie and The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hamid. Both of those are books set in the United States or set partly in the United States that look at America with the eyes of an outsider, of someone who's come to the country from elsewhere, in Nigeria in one case and Pakistan in the other, and report on what they see here in a way that is very different from someone who is thinking about joining the American narrative.
In some ways, releasing this book now, you know, in some ways it's quite brave, especially when we look at the political situation of many countries, which we've been living in the last two decades or so. You know, everybody wanted globalization. People were very happy about it. But now there's some people are not so sure about it. You know, there's the rise of radicalism. But, you know, do you still think we are in a global war no matter what? It's just perhaps a little blip that we're living now.
Well, I think that the reaction against globalization that we're definitely seeing now is itself a reaction to the fact that globalization is occurring and is irreversible process. I think that the reaction against globalization, the desire to retreat and raise borders, national borders, raise walls against each other, is a reaction to this more long-term process. It's one moment in that process. And literature is something that allows us, hopefully, to understand each other across borders, to recognize a common humanity, the fact that we can read stories set all over the world about all different kinds of lives and understand them and identify with them suggests that we have more in common than some politicians would like us to believe.
Eden, let's talk more about your book. I mean, you mentioned, you know, chapter 4, which talks all about the, you know, the America experience. But let's talk about chapter 3. That's a very interesting one. It talks about alternate realities. And you choose the novelists Haruki Murakami and Roberto Bolaño. Tell us a bit more about this one.
They both are novelists who have a worldwide audience and have found acclaim in very different contexts than they were writing in originally. And I wanted to look at what it is about Bolaño and Murakami that makes them so globally appealing. And I think that they're very different writers, but they converge in certain ways. In the two books that I talk about, Bolaño's 2666 and Murakami's 1Q84, they're both writing about an alternative sense of reality, a reality in which evil things and dangerous things seem to be increasingly present. And it's a way of writing about the world we live in, but in a fictional and sometimes even science fictional spirit. And that's one way of capturing a global reality, is to write about the strangeness of the world that we live in now.
And finally, in the last chapter, you talk about the very popular novels from Elena Ferrante, which, you know, she talks about, you know, her own city, the Neapolitan environment. Tell us a bit more about this one, how this can be global.
Well, the Ferrante novels that I write about, the Neapolitan novels, that series of four books, start out on a very small scale, on a local scale, a neighborhood, a poor neighborhood in Naples. And as they follow the course of the two main characters' lives, their world broadens. It becomes first Italian in scope, then European in scope, and finally they are joining worldwide developments and movements. One character becomes a feminist writer, another character becomes a computer programmer. They're both responding to generational changes that are affecting people of their generation all over the world, of technology and society, gender relations. And I think the Ferrante novels are a very elegant example of how we are all thinking that our world is no bigger than a neighborhood or a street. Eventually, our lives end up under the aegis of developments that are happening all over the world.
That was Adam Kirsch talking about his book, The Global Novel, Writing the World in the 21st Century, and that is out, published by Columbia Global Records. We're going to quickly nip to the Barbican in London now, where this weekend a celebration of classical music called Sound Unbound is taking place. It showcases composers and musicians who are pushing the boundaries of what classical music means today. And one such composer is Sven Helbig, whose sound comprises of choral and ambient music. And he speaks to producer Holly.
I'm always surprised because I thought we would have had some success during the last 20 years of crossover music. And with the internet, where everything is just mixed up and it doesn't need you to go to a record store and discover something and bring it home and listen to it. But still, there is some invisible wall around the concert halls and the orchestras and all the behavior that comes with it. And that's why it's great to have a festival like this in the Barbican, that stands for mixing the genres and mixing the music and the cultures.
So what do you think classical music means in 2017?
For the most people, it means using the wooden instruments, you know, if they see a cello or a violin. And this is part of the problem, because there are so many different genres now in the 21st century that we cannot all put this in the huge shelf classical music. We have the new genre that many people call modern classical or neoclassical, around Olafur Arnalds or Max Richter and Hauschka and many others. Then we have the modern stream that goes with the Vienna school still. Then we have the old classical music. Even this is divided into so many different things. There's the opera, the symphonic, the choir, the chamber. It's really hard to say. I think the most people think classical means the whole package. Going to the concert hall, having a mixed program, having the orchestra in black suits, you know, all this lights still on in the concert. And so this whole experience.
I wonder how you got to where you are in your career, because I guess a lot of people who are trained classical musicians will stick with that and, you know, do the performances that everybody knows in the classical music halls. But obviously you combine choral music with ambient music and electronic music. When did you decide that you wanted to sort of go down that hybrid route?
I think this was not a decision. It had to do with the totally empty cultural space where I grew up in Eisenhüttenstadt, which is a small planned city in the far east of Germany, where we did not have an orchestra, a theater, concert hall or anything. And my parents haven't been interested much in music. I mean, they are not musicians. And so there was never something too dominant that sucked me in. You know, not a classical tradition or not something else or friends that listened to a particular music. It was all empty. And I was constructing radios when I was a very young guy, like 11 years. So there was some electronic music. There was some R&B that came over from the Berlin radio station, from the American Army. There was, in the night, was classical music. And so it was all mixed up. It was all my own. I always loved to live in all those worlds, and I did not notice the division. Then I played the drums in the same time that I played the clarinet, because I loved Tosca so much, and I loved to play some R&B stuff on the drums, and this all was, yeah, it was the same physical effect to my body.
And tell us a bit about what you're going to be performing this weekend at Sound Unbound.
This is my recent album, which is just choir music and bits of electronic music. Musically, it's the choir and on top the high frequencies and the low end below what the bass can sing, some synth energy and synth sounds. This time I wrote all the lyrics by myself as well. The whole thing is called I Eat the Sun and Drink the Rain. And I choose the choir because it's about the human search for salvation, for eternity, and for overcoming their limitations.
That was the composer Sven Helbig, who's taking part in the Barbican Sound Unbound event this weekend, and tickets are available now. And we're nearing the end of the show now, so of course it's time to invite Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco back into the studio for this week's Global Countdown. Faye, welcome.
Hello, Rob.
Back.
Hello, everyone.
Now, you've taken us on all sorts of sonic, interesting journeys over the past few weeks, from Nigeria to China. Where are we going today?
Well, today we're going to the most important chart of them all, the American singles chart, the Hot 100. And I chose because finally Ed Sheeran's not number one anymore. So I said, that's the moment. So I think we should, well, kind of celebrate. Let's see what you think about number one, which is still a secret. But there's another interesting element of this, Rob. Last week was the first time there was no female artist in the top 10 in the US for 33 years.
Really?
So the last time this happened was 1984. So the new chart that just came out today, actually, it's saying that Alessia Cara jumped to number 7, so that's not the case anymore. But it is impressive because in recent years, you know, had Adele, Beyoncé, Lady Gaga, you know, very important, you know, female presence. But I think this year, men are doing particularly well in the charts.
Okay, so where are we going to start? We're not going to do the top 10. We're starting with the top 5, right?
Exactly, a little countdown.
And we've got 5 geezers lined up. Where are we going first? Who's number 5?
Number 5 have the, you know, American hip-hop artist Future with a track Mask Off. I think that's his biggest hit so far. And I think, you know, every week that I come here, there's always some sort of challenge. And again, there's another dance challenge. And that's one of the reasons why this track is so successful. So a lot of people are sharing the videos called the Mask Challenge. It's a very simple choreography. I mean, I think you just go down and up. You know, I tried myself. It's nothing much, but it became a hit in the US. And I think it's helping a lot of the streaming. And that's why he's number five.
I think we need some of this in the office upstairs, Faye.
And he uses a flute as well on this track. That's also okay. Quite an important
thing. He uses a flute to do what?
Oh,
to play.
To play.
I thought it was. Thought that was something else entirely.
Watch a lot of Anchorman? There's a lot of flute dancing in Anchorman.
Yeah,
is
exactly.
It the same
goes the full Jethro Tull. Yeah. Okay, number four.
Number four, we have Kendrick Lamar with DNA. That's one of the singles from his new album, Damn. And I have to talk about Damn because, you know, it's been the biggest opening week for an album in the US this year, with more than 600,000 copies being sold. And the industry was expecting between 500 and 550, so it's quite a success. But there's more about Lamar a bit later. So let's move on to number three.
You're keeping him hidden. For the moment.
Exactly. Okay. I'm so bad at hiding secrets, but anyway.
Kendrick is hidden. I love it. Okay, number three. Who's number three?
We have Bruno Mars with That's What I Like. It's the second single from 24K Magic. And I was thinking, because I don't know about you guys, I'm not the biggest fan of Bruno Mars, but he's efficient. I mean, he does deliver a nice beat. He's a bit like
efficient.
Brad, you know? Like
efficient pop
He's
star.
Really efficient.
Yeah, efficient. He's efficient.
He's done his expenses. He's got to the plane on time. He's sold out. I mean, what more can you ask him other than not being that excited?
Exactly.
I find him weirdly endearing, and I don't understand it. But whenever I see him like doing couple karaoke or like on screen or even on stage, like he's very he's like a nice man.
He is.
You know, he has a way with a hat.
Exactly. You know,
Georgia, you're sort of you won't be drawn on Bruno, will you?
I admire him. He knows how to write an efficient. He does know how to write a nugget of a pop track.
Yeah.
I could sing that song to you, even though I've never actually gone and listened to it. I've heard it on things or on the radio or whatever.
We could put on the poster, efficient.
So,
imagine. Yeah.
He gets those little worms out into the world and then...
He does.
You know.
It's a worm charmer.
Well, moving to number two, another guy...
I think what's wrong with me today? Sorry, what's number two? Faye?
Well, he's kind of he has the same Bruno Mars type of vibes with Ed Sheeran, Shape of You. Mm. After 12 weeks at number one, that's an impressive number. Finally.
I've forgotten now what Shape of You. I've known something about a Galway girl. No, I've been doing up my house and listening to a lot of Radio 2 for the last few weeks.
The Shape of You is I'm in love with your body.
Okay.
It is better than Galway Girl.
Yeah, which is
it is
Galway
better.
Galway Girl. Which needs, you know.
One of the worst things I've ever
it's
heard.
It's really bad.
I just wish that every time they played Galway Girl, they replaced it with C'est la vie by Bewitched, who created this theme in the first place. And
it's a much better song.
But so much better.
The opener of the album where he raps is interesting.
That's another...
Let it hang.
Yeah, where he raps.
But Shape of You, actually, give Sharon the credit, it is a tune.
It's a bit of a banger, yeah.
Okay.
I agree.
And with a drum roll, should we play a bit of it?
Let's do it. See, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Bitch, be humble. Hold up, bitch. Sit down. Hold up, be humble. Hold up, bitch. Sit down.
Okay, the unmistakable voice of who are we talking about?
Kendrick Lamar with Humble, the main single from his new album. And I very much welcome this new number one. You know, the video clip's fantastic. I mean, he's dressed as some sort of a young pope. And again, I love the way he uses imagery. I think it's a fantastic track. A lot of different beats and quite accessible, you know, especially compared to his previous singles as well. Who knows, maybe he'll get the Grammy for Best Album of the Year next year. You never know. If Adele doesn't release anything before.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this is an all-male top five. An all-male top ten, did you say?
Well, this week, you know, we had Alessia Cara with a partnership with Zedd. So we can't say that actually, you know, we have a woman actually in the top ten. But again, there's not many of them, and you might ask the reasons. I was reading a Billboard article. I mean, to be honest, you know, it's nothing against women, or apparently it's just because most of the singers, they run out of their singles from their latest albums. And, you know, we have Selena Gomez, a lot of people.
I love that they've run out. We've run out.
Yeah.
So we're all out of singles. Love.
I think it was just a strange coincidence in a way. And for example, Katy Perry, Chained to the Rhythm, you know, it's a nice track, but apparently didn't do as well as people were predicting as well. So there was a little...
I think it's natural to follow. Like, it was such a huge year. 2015, 2016, you had big releases from Taylor Swift, Adele, Beyoncé, Solange. And it's only natural that it's a rise and a fall.
It is a rise and fall. We're all kind of vibing to Kendrick there. What are we thinking about Damn?
I love it. Yeah, I think Alice. He's great.
Yeah, Faye?
I agree, and I think Humble especially, I think it's a fantastic single.
Yeah.
And I can't stop watching the video as well.
I was just going to say, there's a track on the album called Pride as well, which is a really different sound to that, and then there's a U2 collaboration, a Rihanna collaboration. I don't know that it's going to be, I think with To Pimp a Butterfly, that was, I think you could say that was an album of a generation. That was one of those records that was so powerful. I'm not sure that this has the same capability in terms of where it will be in the canon of music over the last 10 years. Do you know what I mean?
But it would almost be impossible for him to create that
exactly
again,
but I do, yeah, really. I'm sort of in a process where I want to listen to it more and discover more.
I agree. I think Damn, you know, I think To Pimp a Butterfly is a better album, but this one is quite accessible in some ways.
Yeah.
I think the songs can be quite catchy as well. I think he would do well.
Well, obviously on the deluxe CD there is a cover of Kendrick Lamar's version of Galway Girl by Ed Sheeran, which we've all got our ears cocked for. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you to my guests Alice Vincent and Georgie Rogers. The show is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thank you also, Fernando. Join us again at the same time next week, but for the time being, for me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in, and we'll play out with Humble.
Nobody pray for me, it been a day for me. Yeah, yeah. Hey, I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances, Vanessa nigga with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this Parmesan with my accountant lips. In fact, I'm down in this. You say with my boo, babe, tastes like